Ryan. I'm happy to say
this meeting is being recorded.
Is joining us from Boston, where it is mid-afternoon. And Hank has had the pleasure of already talking to Janice Hallett, whose debut novel, The Appeal, this is. I will mention that we have autographed book plates to go with our books. And this is our February British Crime Book of the Month, because I just love it. It's so much fun. Anyway, since Hank has already spoken to Janice, I thought that it would be wonderful if she shares her enthusiasm for The Appeal with you before she might have to leave us. So Hank, over to you.
Oh my goodness. Thank you, Barbara. I am so honored to be here today. When I read this book, the marvelous The Appeal, the pleasure was not only in interviewing Janice, but in absolutely reading this book, which is unique and ingenious and riveting. And from the standpoint of being an author, must have been so difficult to write. So you know, all of you who are listening, this book is written. Well, Janice, you tell us how you put this together.
It is written, it's a modern epistolary novel, so it's written in email, text, and, you know, other kind of messaging apps all the way through, pretty much. So it's quite different.
Well, it's different and it's marvelous, and it's letters and it's playbills and it's only these documents, including yellow sticky notes. And one of the things that really made me, it's so enjoyable and so much fun to read. I know I'm gushing and babbling, but this is just really original and unique. You all do not miss this. It really made me think about how you have deconstructed what a story is, and then a novel, and then put it back together in this very puzzle-like, ingenious way. So you're calling the reader to action to solve this mystery. Talk a little bit about how you got there.
Well, it was quite an accident how I got there. I had the idea about the basic story behind The Appeal, but then I thought, how about I take the minor characters and look at the emails whizzing back and forth between them, because that would be a great way to eavesdrop on what's going on, and we'd hear what people really thought of each other instead of having a narrator explain, for example. So that was where it came from, and it was quite it was a spur of the moment decision that luckily worked out.
Well, because think about it, people who are listening now, think about if you had a list, if you had a stack of someone's emails and documents, it would be fascinating to read, as Janice said, sort of eavesdropping on someone's lives. But the way you have set this up is that a lawyer sends a letter to his two clerks, someone who we think is a pretty prominent lawyer, sends a letter to people who we think are his two clerks, saying, here's a bunch of documents. Look through these. They're in sort of chronological order and see what you can make of that. And you set the reader to the task of figuring out not only what's happened, but who's involved and why. How did you think of that construct to keep it all of a piece?
I did that really to help me stay abreast of the story, because very soon after writing these emails, I kind of realized that the reader will need a bit of help through this. So I stopped there. It's before 20,000 words, so pretty early on in the book, went back and conjured up these lawyer students who were looking through it with the reader's eye. So we're with them the whole time. But there's a controlling force, their boss. So I thought that would be a good way to frame it and to lead us through what would be quite an unconventional narrative.
Well, so the two clerks, Charlotte and Femi, who we only meet in their discussion of these documents, are struggling with what happened. And at one point, and this gives nothing away, one of them says to the other, it seems like this is something about a community theater. And the other one says, I don't know what this is about, but it's not about a play. Talk about the story, and then how that went together.
Well, the story that they're looking at is it's about a community theater group, and about the leading lights of that group, the Alpha family that run it. Now, their granddaughter is diagnosed with a terrible condition, and her only hope, they're told, is some very expensive drug treatment from America. So they immediately set about fundraising among the community, the family and friends that live around them to raise this money. Now, most people throw themselves into that to help their friend, but there are some other characters, and there's a couple who've recently arrived following 10 years as medical volunteers in Africa. So they've seen a lot and their lives have been very different, and they have a different perspective on this tiny community. And that kind of causes ructions one way or the other, and it leads to murder.
But the play is set in this, in a little town where there's a certain class structure of the Alpha family, as you say, at the top, and the newcomers and the wannabes and the people who are sort of inured in that system. The appeal, one of the reasons for the title, The Appeal, is this financial appeal to raise money for poor Poppy, who's clearly got cancer. And the other is a legal appeal for someone at some point who is accused of murdering someone. So this double title, and you know, I think it's also a triple title, but also the appeal of belonging in a certain place in society, the appeal of who has a better life than you do, the appeal of being someone that you're not. And you have this background in community theater that allows you to shine a spotlight on this so brilliantly.
Yeah, I mean, I did community theater from the age of 14. Until the group itself folded when I was in my 40s. So yeah, a long, long time. I mean, I met my partner there. I met most of my friends come from there. And yeah, it's a great hobby to do. It's well, you're like a family when you work on a play together. You're like a family, the stakes are very high. So it's a really intriguing world in which to set a drama.
And at the beginning of the book, you all see this? You have the list of characters in the play they're putting on and who they are, and the little yellow stickies from the lawyer to Charlotte and Femi, sort of explaining some of the relationships, which is just one of the many ways in the book that you shepherd us through reading this book. Your book makes me think about, and Barbara, come in whenever you want, of course. The book makes me think about how we are all storytellers when we write a letter, when we write an email, when we make a report, because it's the history that we want to be real. We are creating the history that we want. We're being persuasive or newsy or setting down the facts as we see them or rationalizing or making stuff up. And you see that in these emails. Talk a little bit about being each of the people that wrote the emails and how instantly recognizable they are.
And this is how it looks, by the way.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea.
Which is a good idea. Let me just add too, before she answers that, you know, I mean, forever, Hanks, there, you know, I'm a speed reader. I can't read Dickens, for example, because I cannot read dialect. I just can't do it. All the Dickens I've ever known, you know, I've seen in either film or television or something. I'm never going to know what Becky Sharp got up to. I mean, it's just not going to happen for me. And so I was really apprehensive about opening this book, knowing that it had this structure. And I have to say, Janice, that I'm amazed that it read just as quickly as if it were a conventionally presented narrative. I didn't have any of that, you know, throwing me out. So I mentioned that in case any of you are thinking this is going to test your reading skills. It really doesn't. And the other thing I would say, which I thought was genius, is by inserting the lawyers into this, you created a ticking clock for this book, because they only have whatever it is, like 3 days or something, to review all of this material for the Queen's Counsel. That his question is the right person in prison for the crimes that we're about to read about? So I like the fact that you created a, you know, an urgency here that makes everything go along faster. Did that only happen when you decided to introduce the lawyers? Did it sort of ramble up till then? it might.
I instinctively put that timing on because of coming from screenwriting for TV and film. There's often a time limit when you write scripts and stories for film and TV to create an urgency in it. I think I did that instinctively in this, purely from coming from that world. But as Hank was saying, I mean, I spend an awful lot of time working on each email so that the reader wouldn't have to pay too much attention to the email headers, who things were to and from, that as soon as the person opened up their email, you knew who it was and you knew who they were talking to, because it's different for each character talking to each other character. I spend an awful lot of time immersed in the dynamics of the book to get that right, so you can read it and so it can wash over you and you can relax while you're reading and it still goes in. So I mean, I hope that happens and that comes across to, well, so it's good to hear.
I told Janice, apropos of what you're saying, Barbara, exactly, when we talked, I said, when I realized that this book was in emails and documents, my subconscious was saying, oh, please don't make me read this. Please don't make me read this. I frankly don't want to read this. And it was instantly immersive, instantly easy to read. It, as you were saying, it just washes over you. And Janice has crafted these emails so that, you know, there's someone who uses a lot of exclamation marks and a lot of XX, and there are some that are very, very terse. You completely understand the people who are writing the emails, just as we open emails from each other and we know who they're from. And so anyone who is, as Barbara says, anyone who is apprehensive, as we both were, about reading this, it takes a page to get to it. The other thing that you do that is so brilliant is Femi and Charlotte, the law clerks, just at the point of the book where, I mean, every single time where I was thinking, what? Could it be this? Then up pop Charlotte and Femi saying just exactly the same thing. And they'll say, one of them will say, do you get this? And the other one says, yeah, 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 here's what the deal is. And the other one says, oh yeah, I should have seen that. So you are so, you have made this interactive, you've made an interactive novel.
Oh, definitely interactive, immersive. It's like a sort of video game. It's you engage a part of your brain that you often don't usually engage while reading. That was all deliberate, and I paid a lot of attention in the edit to where the reader might need some help to get up to speed if they were reading in bits or if they were reading all together. So yeah, we paid a lot of attention in the edit to that.
Before I headed into a digression, I've totally forgotten the question that I interrupted that you asked her, Hank. Do you remember what it is?
Yes, it was about the individualization of the emails to make them be instantly.
So we didn't lose that. Right. So, you know, I think it would be helpful because not everybody is fully immersed in British culture, that you explain, first of all, what is a Queen's Counsel and why are these two people working for him? Let's start with the real basics here, and then we'll go on to the National Health Service.
A QC, your Queen's Counsel, is a very senior barrister. So they're involved in the court procedure. Whereas Femi and Charlotte, they start off as law students, and he's their visiting tutor. But the novel spans a certain amount of time. So by the end, they're article clerks. So they've moved on there. So yeah, it's a very senior barrister, taking juniors under his wing, really, and getting them both to help him. But he's also helping them. And he spotted something in them that will help him bring this.
If you never watch Rumpole of the Bailey, which is, you know, one way you can determine all this, barristers are the people who go to court and are allowed to argue. Solicitors are the lawyers who do all the paperwork. They're the guys that do the real estate work and, you know, the tax and the wills and all that conveyancing, everything. So, and a Queen's Counsel is a barrister who takes silk, as they call it. And so he's very senior and he's the guy you would bring in because they're expensive for a major case. And then he would have a support staff like any trial lawyer in the United States. Well, Hank, you're married to a lawyer, so you know how all this goes.
Well, I know how it works in the United States, and I've watched Silk on TV, so I've got this.
Right, but, you know, so anyway, the two clerks I find interesting because he's tossing this review to very junior, as you say. Why would he do that in favor of somebody more senior? Is it mostly because this is a personal thing for him? He just wants to be sure that the right person is in prison or the wrong person gets out, whatever it is?
Yeah, he wants young, fresh people. He wants, I think his words are, he wants fresh eyes on the case, and you don't get fresher than keen law students. That's his thinking behind it. He wants, you know, a fresh, an interesting perspective on it to see what they'll come up with.
Who are they?
Oh, go ahead.
I was just, now you go on, because my question is more basic. Carry on.
Well, I think that another reason that it's so marvelous to have Charlotte and Femi, the sort of newbie wannabe lawyers, is that we feel as readers, we're coming into it very purely with fresh eyes as well. And we feel that we're sort of in exactly the same position as Charlotte and Femi. And we also put ourselves, you know, we think maybe we can figure it out before they do. And it's so much fun to be on this adventure, on this journey with them, figuring it out with them. So it's yet another way that you bring the reader right into the book.
Yeah, no, it's a real challenge to the reader. I mean, I think that that's fun. It makes you participate in what's going on. What is the basic thing that's going on, Janice? We can't give too much away, but, you know, who is Poppy, and what is the core of what's happening here?
Poppy is the little girl who is the focus of the Haywood family and who they're looking to buy the drug treatment for. So that it's the Poppy appeal that they're raising money for. And I'm not sure what else I can say that won't give anything away.
Well, I think you might explain about the National Health Service, because, you know, in America, this thing would go differently. So.
Right. Yeah. Of course, in the UK, we wouldn't pay for our treatment. But if you are diagnosed with something, you know, as bad as a Poppy has been diagnosed with, you might have options to source drug treatment that's either offered elsewhere in the world or is experimental elsewhere in the world, and you would have to pay for that. And it's certainly at the time I started writing the novel, I was seeing a lot of those fundraising campaigns on Facebook. That was a lot of that about. So it did occur to me, you know, that we will pay, you know, we will raise money for healthcare when it's a very, very serious disease or when it's a child. So that was in my mind as I was writing the novel at first. But yeah, so we although we don't pay for our healthcare, there in certain circumstances we have there are options that people will go abroad to look for treatment that's not available on the NHS.
So we call it crowdfunding, don't we, Hank? Most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having a GoFundMe page or something.
Right.
Like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
But,
yeah.
But in Britain, it's called an appeal, and it seemed to have a little more formal structure to the way you would go about an appeal than perhaps crowdfunding, which seems to me has a wide variety of possible organizing factor. I mean, you know, I read about a couple that raised money through crowdfunding, GoFundMe or whatever, to drive their Volkswagen bus around Patagonia or something. So, you know, there doesn't seem to be necessarily what most people would think of as a worthy cause behind some of these. But I had a feeling from the way they went about it that it's a little more structured in the UK. Would that be true?
It can be. When they're talking about amounts that are as large as this, although technically, I suppose Poppy's appeal is a crowdfunding campaign. Mm-hmm. Sarah Jane, one of the characters, jumps on board and ratchets it up a notch, really, to make it a proper, charity fundraising campaign. And she brings it onto another footing. And I think she's one of the most compelling characters in the book. In the end, her energy really drives this campaign forward, and makes it official for a lot of the people in there.
I'm going to have to pop off, Barbara and Janice, but let me just say quickly in closing, in writing a novel, one of the things I always think about is what does someone want and why and how far will they go to get it? And you have captured that so gorgeously and so rivetingly in the appeal. I cannot praise you enough. I cannot, if I could stand up, I would stand and applaud for this book. And oh my goodness, thank you for Her Perfect Life, Patrick. That's so nice of you. This is a treasure of a novel, Janice, and congratulations on all of it. And I have ordered The Twyford Code, your next book. So Barbara, I hope you all will talk about Izzy and Sarah Jane and Poppy and the people who don't appear in the novel, and how you chose who would be in the novel. And I wish I could stay forever and congratulate you, but thank you, Barbara, for including me in this. It's so much fun to let the world know about this book.
Thank you, Hank,
very much. Hank is just such a brilliant interviewer, and it's wonderful to have one writer speak to another about, you know, writing kinds of things, which contributes so much to it. So thank you, Hank, very much
my
for
pleasure,
joining us. I'll see you again soon.
Yes.
Right. So here we are, Janice, you and me. Let's go back. I'm hoping that my internet connection, which can wobble in my library slightly, but I'm so bored with always being in my office, which isn't nearly as scenic. So if I freeze, Patrick will have to pop in and rescue us. Let's go back and talk about the structure a bit, because I think the epistolary novel is a fascinating way to solve a lot of problems. And I remember reading Pamela by Richardson, which may or may not be the first novel in English, but anyway, it's a deal. And it seemed to me that the thing that worked so well was it allowed different voices to come in, before we had any real grasp on how to tell stories that way. And it also created a timeline, because the letters are moving back and forth and dated, so that the reader, you know, keeps up. So was that part of your thought? Are you a reader of the epistolary novel? Isn't it Lady Susan? Isn't that the Austin that's an epistolary novel?
Susan something. Sure. Tenant of Wildfell Hall was one that I remember. Anne Bronte.
Right. But I think that it was one. Austin's first whatever, and it was her way of sort of learning how to structure a story. I'm pretty sure it's called Lady Susan. So, you know, did that pop into your mind when you started thinking about writing the appeal?
Not much did pop into my mind when I started it. I started it in such a free kind of way. I didn't have a deadline. It wasn't commissioned. It was written completely on spec. It was a spur of the moment decision, really, to move from screenwriting to novel writing. I didn't think of any separate idea. I just started on the same idea I'd been thinking of for a script. And that was how I launched it. One thing that I started off writing but then changed was when I first wrote the appeal, I didn't put any dates in or times. I just concentrated on the characters. And it's only when I got to the end, really, that I realised it did need dates. And in fact, that would be an opportunity to put in a few more twists and things some readers might notice, some might not. So that was quite a big job then to put all the dates in and all the times. But I think it was worth it, because it does give it an air of authenticity for a start. But it's also another clue, or lots of other clues.
True. They are clues, but it also gives you such a concrete structure, you know, mm-hmm. in that the reader can, in fact, if necessary, flip back, you know, to see whatever time and date. Because I mean, one thing about email that's interesting is not only the date, it's actually the time. So you can see, you know, whether it was like an instant reply or, you know, took a while, however it was. But then when you have the conversations with the attorneys, you know, they have different because they're actually texting, aren't they?
They are. They're on a WhatsApp style bubble.
A WhatsApp. So the attorney stuff looks like this, where they're just chattering back and forth. But if you're into this is the email structure, where, you know, it has the proper heading. So it'll say from Joyce Walford, reoccur for Poppy. Then we have the date and the time, and then to the recipient. We're all familiar with that. So, you know, I think your novel works in part because by now people are accustomed to email. It might have, you know, years back been a little more of a challenge to the average reader, but now we know what to expect. I love it.
I think we've all developed an email.
With this, you know, screenwriting is mostly dialogue, right?
It's not to do with dialogue and very, very sparse explanation of where you are. It's very technical kind of writing, screenwriting. So, it's the dialogue is where you deliver character. So when you think I've been writing scripts that way, and then look at the appeal. I mean, it's quite a kind of authentic generation from one to the next, really. It was it wasn't a difficult transition to make, bearing in mind that I chose the epistolary form.
Right. Well, I mean, I think your screenwriting experience certainly helps, you know, make this a polished kind of a piece. One of the other things about doing this with email and WhatsApp and so forth is you can bring so many players into the story. You know, you don't have to gather them all up in the room, you know, like a Rex Stout, where you wind up, you know, with the suspects and all of it in Nora Wolf, you know, in the study, in the bad guy in the yellow chair, usually, or however it went. But you can have all these different voices, and they don't even have to be in the UK if you, you know, don't want them to be. In fact, aren't there some emails from Africa as part of this?
Yeah, and there's in fact one member of the community who is traveling around the world, and she's emailing very inappropriate things all the way through. So there are some light moments in this, although it is about raising money for a child's medical treatment. It's quite a there's a light touch as well. I think it's quite a funny novel to read, for a comedy of manners, I suppose.
Well, it is, yeah. But I mean, you can have an almost infinite cast when they are contributing like that. Now, before we started, I asked you about the sequel, which is already, your second novel, which is already published in the UK. And I'm not sure I pronounced it. Is it pronounced Twyford or Twyford?
Yes, the Twyford Code.
The Twyford Code. So tell us a bit about the structure of the Twyford Code, because you've taken it up another step.
Well, it's not, well, I mean, it's not traditionally epistolary, but it is kind of. I mean, it's the main character whose story we're hearing is illiterate, so he can't write, but he's written this book for us. And the way he's done it is he's recorded his story on an iPhone 4, and it's been put through automatic transcription software to create the audio files that we're reading. So this automatic software has introduced various things that it does. It blanks out any swearing or anything it thinks is swearing. It will mishear words, but will just put down what it thinks. And it'll mishear the same words in the same way or in different ways all the way through. So there's a kind of a layer of sort of a filter that's been put over the text that you're reading. And it's surprisingly, though, how quick you can see through it and how you can still read what is meant. It's like those things you got on Facebook a few years ago where you get a sentence and every letter was wrong apart from the first and the last letter of each word, but you could still read it. There's something about language that's a function and that's automatic. And we don't realize quite how easy we can take in what we're reading. So, I mean, hopefully that's as good a read as the appeal.
Well, you do, you know, so are you writing like modern comedies of manners using these interesting new storytelling techniques?
I'm not sure. Maybe. I don't really think much before I start writing. It's a really organic evolutionary process for me. I kind of just have fun. And I hope what comes out at the end is something that other people enjoy. That's my, well, you know.
I mean, you were a number one Sunday Times bestseller with The Appeal. So clearly plenty of people enjoyed it. And now you're
so far, so good.
Yeah, you're going to be here in the United States. So have you, you know, formed, I mean, now that you're a published writer and a best-selling writer, you must spend time with other writers. What kind of feedback have you had from them? Are they envious? Are they curious? What sort of reaction have you gotten?
Really supportive. You know, I have to say, I'm on Twitter quite a bit, and Book Twitter, that's all the authors and readers and bloggers and reviewers and people who chat about books on Twitter. It's a really supportive place. And touch wood, I haven't, you know, had, you know, any negativity at all. I mean, everyone is supportive of each other. I think writers appreciate how hard it is and how hard it is to get where you get. So, you know, I certainly don't resent anybody, and hope no one is envious of me either. You know, it's all hard. We're all on our own journey as writers.
It'd be interesting to see, you know, whether if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, it'll be interesting to see if anyone else, you know, but there was Meg Cabot, wrote a really good book, the name of which has totally escaped me, but it was all, and it was quite a long time ago, it was all done in emails. And part of the fun of the storytelling were the headers in the emails and, you know, the names that people adopted as their, you know, email identity and so forth were absolutely wonderful. I think it's, I might be wrong. If she's written more like that, that's the only one I've read, because she's written other conventional stories. So I guess the question for you would be, you know, now that you've wandered into this do you feel now that you have to continue to write in this epistolary, you pronounce it differently.
I might not even pronounce it properly.
No, you're probably right. There's, you know, American and English are two different languages, so we have to get used to that. But I mean, now, do you feel like, you know, you're going to be expected to write like this, or do you think you could suddenly sit down and write a more conventionally narrated novel, or wouldn't you want to bother with it?
Well, I've got a whole load of ideas for, you know, books and other things. And I kind of treat each idea separately. So the appeal came to me as emails. The Twyford Code came to me in the particular way it did. And certain other, I mean, I've got some other ideas I want to do, but they just wouldn't work with emails or with text or with audio, anything. They would have to be a fairly conventional narrative to get them out. Hopefully if my career pans out that I can eventually write those particular books, that will be a more conventional narrative, and hopefully that will best serve that story. So I always think that there has to be more than just what might be seen as a gimmick. There has to be a reason for that format, for that story in that format. And if there isn't, then it shouldn't be in that format. So I hope that, you know, at some point I will write a more conventional narrative. Fingers crossed I'll get to do it.
Well, I wasn't pushing you in that direction. I was just curious, because, you know, the whole branding thing with modern publishing is that people come to expect a writer to produce, you know, a particular kind of work. I'm hoping that you can resist that pressure. I agree with you that the story should dictate. This conversation, Janice, comes up with people who write series. And, you know, every once in a while, a series author will have an idea for a story that doesn't fit the series. You know, it's wrong for the characters, or it's in the wrong time or wrong place or whatever. And sometimes they're able to write that book. Sometimes they feel pressured, you know, discouraged from doing it while you're building your career. So it helps that you have been such a success out of the box. You have more clout with your publisher, having been successful and unpredictable to some degree, that, you know, to allow people to follow you into something, than if you had started differently. So, you know, it's a gamble. How does your agent react? You know, you must, with a successful contract, you must have had an agent. Was it hard to find an agent?
Well, it was, but not for books. I mean, I did have, way back in my career, years and years where I couldn't get an agent at all. This is back when I was screenwriting. I even had a film made with a co-writer, and still couldn't get an agent for many years. So, I mean, I am one of those writers whose career was held up, really, for lack of an agent for a long, long time. But that was back then. So Lucy Fawcett at She'll Land in London is my screenwriting author. But I was lucky, really, because the same agency also represents novel writers. So when I was ready to write a novel, Lucy could pass that manuscript on to Gaia Banks. And so that was a fairly easy transition compared to other writers who perhaps may be represented by a screenwriting agent but not have access to novel agents. So that was fairly easy, but back in the day I did have a problem finding an agent.
Well, you want to have an agent who's enthusiastic about your work. If they don't believe in it, then they're not going to be able to sell it. So what was your agent's reaction when confronted with this interesting book?
And they were really supportive, all from the word go. I mean, that they were the first people, both Lucy and Guy, to read those early versions of the appeal. I mean, they read the first version was 200,000 words. No, it's 100,000, not 200,000, 100,000 words long. So 20,000 words longer than the book we've got here. And it was all emails between Izzy and Sam, who, if you've read the book, you'll know that Izzy emails Sam a lot, and they're very intense emails. Well, there were a great many more of those in the original version. So Lucy and Gaia read that, and they gave me some very crucial feedback on that first draft to cut those emails out and to do various other things. And so, yeah, they were brilliant, actually, brilliant.
That's wonderful. I know part of the editorial process involves pruning. Sometimes authors don't write anything quite long enough, but most of the time there's extra material, and the book that finally emerges should be one that has been pruned and sculpted and all the rest of it, so that there are not, as Elmore Leonard famously said, I leave out the words that readers skip. And you know, which is a wonderful, I'm not sure, that may be apocryphal, but you know, basically that was his idea. He was also opposed to adverbs, so I'm not sure if I'm mixing all that up, but yeah, I can see that, you know, whittling it down to its essence would be a big thing. But also, don't you think, Janice, when you're telling yourself a story, when you're writing it, inevitably you wind up with some repetition?
I think we might have lost Barbara. She was talking about repetition. Are you back, Barbara? We lost you for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's this internet connection again. I'm going to have to stop doing things in my library. Am I back?
You're back now. Your question was about repetition.
I'm back. All right. Sorry. I was talking about the fact that when writers are drafting a novel, oftentimes there's repetitious material because they're telling themselves the story. And, you know, we read it in a concentrated period of time, but for a writer, it could go on for months, days, years, whatever it is. So it's really important that, you know, you go back and remove all those things that are repetitious or unnecessary, and sometimes you have to a different direction occasionally when you were whittling it down.
I'd say repetition is something that certainly my editor always spots, and the proofreaders will spot it too. It's really easy to use the same phrases, the same words, and you don't notice that you're doing it, even when you read your own work back to yourself. So it's really crucial to get almost as many people as possible reading that manuscript and telling you where these little glitchy things might be improved. It's not that something's wrong, perhaps, but where it could be better. That's to get your book the best it can be. What was the second part of your question?
I'm going to have to give up this venue because there's just something that doesn't work with the email. Patrick, you can come and rescue us. I just want to say, if you can still hear me, that one of the other things about the appeal, while it is a British story, there are international elements to the story, and email allows those to come in the way they communicate. So this, in a way, is a kind of global story, which Britain, if not an empire today, at one point was an empire, a global empire. And so, you know, it has some tentacles, so to speak, all over the world. So Patrick, why don't we let you take over before I screw this up?
Sure, no problem. You kind of go in and out. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, it's really an ingenious way of telling a story, you know, because there's no, you know, oftentimes we're sort of, the reader has that comfortable, I'm not sure how to say it, but like an orientation of an omniscient third person narrator kind of guiding you through. And there's not that here, which is wonderful. And the reader is forced to really fill in so much that's not on the page, you know, especially with these lines of text dialogue. You know, the reader's doing a lot of the work you know, filling in the story. Was that fun to kind of construct? It must have been.
It was huge fun. And as I was saying earlier, I didn't have any deadlines, so I could just play with it. And that was what I was doing for most of that first draft, was exploring different ways of speaking about these events, exploring the characters, getting to know them so I could write from their point of view so authentically. It was fun. I think there's a hand going through the appeal, but it's invisible. It's like you're led and you don't realise there's a narrator, because that narrator's, well, it's me, I suppose, but I mean, I haven't said anything in the text. So,
right.
Yeah, you are led through it. I'm just pleased that people have got it. You know, it's so good to hear when they do, because you just don't know.
What's funny is that there are, I'm sure, very subtle differences depending upon, you know, if you're talking by way of a text, or if you're talking by way of an email, or, you know, different kinds of texts have different language or different vocabulary, shorthand. Was it fun playing with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we each have a different approach to each different format. So some people will write emails that are 4 pages long.
Right.
Whereas others will just do one line as if they were writing a text or on WhatsApp. They won't adjust their the way they text for email at all. So it was wonderful to bring out their personality through something so left field, if you like, through something that we don't even realize what we're doing.
It's really become universal, because that's the way we all communicate now. And isn't it interesting how, you think about some of these conventions just over the last 10, 15 years, Barbara, I think we can see you too and hear you. You remember how, like, say, even 15 years ago, when you saw somebody outside in a restaurant or in a coffee shop holding up their phone, you're like, what an a-hole, you know? How rude.
Yes.
How rude. And now you see people, I mean, that's just,
I know it. People think a cone of silence has descended over them, and that they can, you know, speak about intimate details in a room full of people and nobody's actually listening.
Right. So you'd just be like,
I wanted to point out too that, and here's an example of first published in the Lockwood Gazette, that you actually bring in a third person, because you've got excerpts from newspaper coverage and so forth. So, you know, you've got the first person narrative going back and forth in the emails and the messages, but then every once in a while, and then of course you've got the, you know, junior clerks reading, but then every once in a while you get a statement from a newspaper which introduces yet a different voice. So, you know, yeah. This is almost like a masterclass in putting together voice and perspective. Were you able to hear all that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we heard all of that. Yeah, there's also some interviews towards the back, right. Police interviews as well. So there's a slight change in the voice. So it's not entirely 100% emails, but it's mostly emails.
And there are a couple of characters that are crucial to the story that you never really hear from at all. You know, all you know about them is other people's presentation of them. One of them, I think, is a really terrific surprise. So I did think, Janice, that you did a wonderful job surprising us with this very complicated story that I could figure out part of it. I mean, I was pretty sure I knew where part of it was going, but you really surprised me with at least two plot threads. So, you know, it really is a challenge to the reader when you start out. If you pay careful attention, it'd be interesting to see if you manage to get it all before you know what happens.
Yeah, is it interesting? Some people do get it. So it's I think it's possible to get. It's possible to guess.
I'm not sure it's possible to get all of it. I think you can get most of it.
Not all of it.
Yeah. So I didn't feel like crying foul, you know, I didn't feel like saying no fair, you know, you didn't, like, it's all there. It's just remarkably cleverly concealed. Yay. Patrick, are there any questions from the audience? At this time of day, it's not a very large audience as a general rule, but people will watch this for, you know, days thereafter.
Well, I'll keep looking. you know, we forget how many epistolary novels there really are out there. I mean, there's, you know, Dracula is an epistolary novel in many ways. What was the one that they made that wonderful movie with Anthony Hopkins, 84 Charing Cross?
Oh, Road. Yeah, 84 Charing Cross Road, yeah. That's brilliant, yeah.
And the Guernsey Literary Potato Peel Society was a recent example. There's so many. With this cast of characters, did you have fun again, but did certain personalities sort of emerge that surprised you or asserted themselves in ways that you didn't expect?
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, there are a few characters that I think were me at some point in my life, and that I like to think I've moved on from them, but in writing those characters, it felt like I was going back to someone who I once was. And there's certainly a lot of people there that I've observed in my life, both through their emails and their behavior. So yeah, it was a real sort of education really to write the novel, to do something so different.
Was it therapeutic in some ways?
I think it was. Yeah, it's therapeutic because you can give people their comeuppance that perhaps they never had in life. But yes, in that case it is. But yeah, it is great to have characters and to be able to do things with them, to create stories. It's a real privilege to do that. It's a privilege to be a writer. That's what I've discovered this last couple of years.
I do have a question from one of our Facebook viewers, Doug. He says, I'm wondering about the use of email and just a few texts in the novel. Is email that prevalent in the UK? I feel as if here it would be all text. Interesting point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think email was sort of the primary communication a few years ago. I think things, because this is set in 2018, it has moved on here, and we do text and WhatsApp now, I think, more than email, but still email is popular, and particularly among older generations who remember the early days of email, rather like myself, and who still stick to it. So yeah, I mean, I still love it.
Well, it is funny how email has sort of, you know, as you were saying earlier, has sort of mimicked the text form, you know, whereas a couple of years ago, we were all signing off formally and saying our names. Now we, you know, half of us don't even bother with our name. It's just a, you know, almost like a text.
Yeah, sure. Communication is just getting shorter.
Yes.
And so we have less words to say what we want to say, more silences. It's interesting how
and less permanence. You know, unfortunately, you know, it's also volatile that we're not going to end up with, in many cases, papers and, you know, files for researchers and so forth. On the other hand, if you watch crime shows, you recognize that one of the great tools the police have now is they can retrieve all the text correspondence from the, you know, the carrier, from the phone provider. And so people end up inadvertently testifying against themselves based upon, you know, the fact that these electronic communications don't ever really disappear. So on the one hand, you have them disappearing, and on the other hand, they're impermanent. So, you know, you don't wind up with archives. I find it fascinating how that is developing as a librarian and an archivist. Part of it I deplore, but on the other hand, so I wonder if we're going to end up printing out, you know, all of these text messages and so forth in order to keep them as a record. Is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, you can get apps or programs or something or other that you can. I've never done it myself. You can get them printed out if you want for your own records. But yeah, nothing is ever deleted. So you have to be careful what you say to anyone.
Very true. Indeed so. Patrick, is there anything else?
Let's see. Well, I'm looking at that nice row of Penguin classics up there. Who are some of your literary influences or favorite authors?
I like the Victorian novelists, Thomas Hardy, Bronte's, Dickens. Not sure I've read absolutely everything of his, but I do like the ones I've read. Victorian novelists for me, that's my go-to, my comfort reads.
I love Thomas Hardy.
Oh,
yeah.
I like Trollope. I'm very fond of Anthony Trollope. I thought, you know, the Palliser novels are among my favorites. And at one point, they were great television. We tried to go back and watch them recently and recognize the TV has really come a long way. And they look so dated, but they were wonderful. Well, Janice, what a pleasure it's been to meet you. Thank you so much for, I think this is your U.S. book launch, is it not?
Today, yeah, this is my launch for today, I guess. I mean, it's out in the U.S. right now, today. And this is the cast I'm doing today. So yeah, this is it.
Well, what a privilege for us. I know you spoke to Hank the other day, but I'm so delighted that we've gotten a chance to do this. This is really just a marvelous book. And I'm so glad if you belong to our British Crime Club, you will automatically get a copy. If you don't, I urge you to order one and we'll see if we can acquire more book plates, but even without one, the book will read exactly the same. So, and we do have copies of the Twyford Code coming from London. And so if you are interested in that, I urge you to go to our web store and order one really quickly because they're going to disappear with the speed of light.
What is that about, by the way? Can you give us a little synopsis of the...
Yeah, the Twyford Code is about a former prisoner who is set the task by his probation officer to revisit an episode he finds traumatic from his youth. And it's when his teacher disappeared on a school trip. So he has to go back and speak to his old school friends to see what they remember, because he can't remember himself. And he ends up going on a journey, really, through his own life, because he discovers that his teacher found a secret code in a disgraced children's author's works. And thereby, I must stop before I give too much away.
Ooh, secret codes. Oh, so much fun. You know, people who love books also love books about books or books about codes or, you know, all that sort of thing. It's so much fun. We were talking about bibliomysteries last night with a different author and how enduringly popular they are in a literary community. So, anyway, I'm really looking forward to my copy getting here from London, and we'll see what happens. So I hope we'll get to speak to you when it publishes here in the United States. And meanwhile, thank you, Janice, for your time. It's really been a great pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you, Barbara and Patrick. It's been a delight to be here. Thank you.
You bet. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks so much.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.